I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. For many of us, the holidays mean parties and family gatherings full of food. But for 1 out of 8 people in Maryland, it's still a time of not being sure where their next meal is coming from. And a third of those who report food insecurity earn too much to qualify for help from the government. In this hour, Wes Moore, Deborah Flaitman of the Maryland Food Bank, and Michael J. Wilson of Maryland Hunger Solutions discuss hunger, its surprising prevalence, and why it needs to be addressed year-round, not only during the holidays. We'll also hear from the superintendent of Somerset County Public Schools, which now serves free meals to all students. The fight against hunger on Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us. We are, of course, in the thick of this holiday season. It's a safe bet that many of us are counting down the hours until a nice break from work, when we'll attend family gatherings where there will be more food than we know what to do with. But for more than 75,000 Marylanders who report food insecurity, this may not be the case. The Maryland Food Bank estimates that about 1 in 8 Marylanders don't know where their next meal is coming from. And about 1/3 of these individuals may earn too much to qualify for federal or state assistance. Today we'll talk about the prevalence of hunger in Maryland, who is hit by it, and how the problem is being addressed. We'll also speak to the school superintendent of Somerset County, a place where 34% of children and 24% of adults live below the poverty line, about how they're overcoming the stigma of hunger. With me now in the studio is Deborah Flaitman, president and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, a nonprofit hunger relief organization that distributes more than 144,000 meals a day in our state. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Sheila.
And also joining us is Michael J. Wilson. He's director of Maryland Hunger Solutions, a project established under the Food Research and Action Center to fight hunger and improve nutrition, health, and well-being of children and families in Maryland. Michael J. Wilson, I'm so glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
And also with us in studio is Wes Moore. Among his long list of credentials, he is the CEO and founder of Bridge EDU, and he advocates for hunger solutions in Maryland. He and his family have partnered with the Maryland Food Bank to encourage Marylanders to remember those struggling with hunger this holiday season. Wes Moore, welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to see you. Thank you.
Let me start with you, Deborah. What is the picture of food insecurity?
Well, much as what you just described, you know, 1 in 8 Marylanders, 1 in 5 kids actually across the state of Maryland are food insecure, which basically means that on any given day they're waking up and they don't know that they're going to have enough food to sustain for the day.
Yeah, food insecure, as you know, is not a term that most of us use in daily life.
Right.
So you say on any given day.
That's correct.
So when you put a number on it, how many Marylanders are food insecure?
In the entire state, it's about 750,000 people. In our service area, which is every county in the state except for Prince George and Montgomery, it's about 465,000 people.
And so does this mean that at any point in the year they may have a period of waking up and not knowing where the next meal is coming from?
Exactly.
Or when you give that number, are you saying every day there's that many people?
Every day it's that many people, but they're different people depending on their life circumstance. So what we see is there are some folks who are chronically food insecure, but that is not the majority of the people that we serve. The people that we serve are people who are coming in and out of the system repeatedly or not, depending on their life circumstance. One thing that we've seen in recent years is that because of the recession that we went through and so many middle-class families suddenly losing their economic footing, entering into this charitable food distribution system for the first time ever in their lives. And so, you know, they're not familiar with the system itself. They don't know really where to avail themselves of help. And as you mentioned earlier, the other phenomena here is that so many people that we are serving are not eligible for federal programs because they make just a little too much money, but not enough money to keep food on their tables.
Yeah, I want to understand that better. And maybe Michael J. Wilson, you can help me with this. because I saw a number, I think, of 780,000 Marylanders getting food stamps.
That's correct.
And that seems like a pretty close match to the number that we just batted back and forth, Deborah Flatman, 750,000 food insecure Marylanders. And if I just looked at the numbers, I might think, okay, problem solved. We got people who are food insecure, but we also have a federal program that's helping them all. Michael J. Wilson, what's wrong with it?
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, it's you know, you started off by talking about the holidays, and we all know that hunger doesn't really take a holiday, and that Maryland is the wealthiest state in the nation per capita income. But at the same time, 1 in 8 Marylanders is, you know, having a time, a struggle to get food on the table. And so what we know is that the challenges are, you know, are not just at the holidays, that at the end of January, people are going to have the same challenges that they have at the end of December, but people don't have food baskets on Dr. King's birthday the way they do around Christmas.
And when you talk about the end of the month, you're talking about
people who are using food stamps and food stamps running out before the end of the month. And that's when they end up having to call Deb or the Maryland Food Bank or to deal with the Capital Area Food Bank around Washington, D.C., or the Manna Food Center in Montgomery County, or the food pantries all around the state. Because even though some of these folks are working, they're not earning enough to be able to put food on the table for every meal.
And not, Deborah, you're saying some of them, though, who are working, earning a little bit too much. Or maybe a lot too much. I don't know what the cutoffs are. I mean, how hard is it to qualify? Is there any help, any government help we should be focusing on in this conversation aside from food stamps? Are we essentially talking about food stamps?
Well, I think food stamps are the first and best way to address this problem because it's a proven program, it's federal funds, and people qualify based on their income and their expenses. Now, the minimum food stamp benefit in the state of Maryland is $16 a month. So there are some folks who are getting as little as $16 a month, and that doesn't go very far.
Boy, I'll say. $16 a month.
Right. So there are about 3,000 folks in the state of Maryland who are getting $16 a month. And one of the things we're going to be talking about to the state legislature is increasing that minimum benefit by using state dollars. The District of Columbia has just done this. They've increased it so that nobody gets less than $30 a month. And they're considering legislation like this in New Jersey. We in Maryland think it would be a great investment in the people of Maryland to make sure that low-income folks get no less than $30 a month. It's a minimum, and it would be an investment in their health and in their nutrition, and those dollars would get spent in local stores, in local farmers markets. It would be a good investment for the state to make.
What's your estimate of what it would cost for Maryland to supplement federal food stamps to that level?
We think it would cost about $3 million. Mm-hmm. And in a budget that we're told is in excess of $200 million, we think that's a small part to pay and a good investment for the state of Maryland to make.
Wes Moore, I want to pull you into this conversation because I know we have you with us just part of the hour. And I don't think of you as a hunger guy. I think of you as an author. Originally, your first book was The Other Wes Moore, and then your second book, I'm blanking on the title.
The Work.
The Work. And the work, when I've talked to you about that, it has a lot to do with finding worthwhile work. And you've started Bridge EDU, getting involved in education. How did you add hunger to the portfolio of issues that you're focused on, and what are you doing about it?
Well, I think one thing we realize is that when we look at how many people in our city and in our state are hungry, are food insecure, that's not just their issue. It's all of our issue. It's all of our issue because it not just strikes and tests our own personal humanity, but it also tests every other facet that we might be working on. If you have someone who is food insecure, someone who is hungry, someone who is worrying about where their next meal is going to come from, every issue from health is disturbed, education is disturbed, workforce development is disturbed. And so I think anyone who's thinking deeply and trying to think deeply about where we are and where we're trying to go, the basic element of making sure that people have food security and then just some type of nutrition in what they're doing, that becomes a basic facet that we have to focus on. And so I got involved, my whole family is involved in the Save a Seat program with the Maryland Food Bank. And it was important for my whole family to be involved in this, you know, both because we have a four-year-old daughter and a two-year-old son. And I'm thankful that you know, food insecurity is not something that they have had to worry about. That's not something they have had to deal with, per se, on an individual level. But when we brought them over to places like the Baltimore Dream Center, which is over in Brooklyn, over in South Baltimore, and this was just last Friday, and you see how many families, as soon as those doors open, just start flooding in to the Dream Center. How many children, babies, are coming in.
This was an event that promised that there would be food?
That's exactly right. Event that just simply said, come for a hot meal. And you get a chance to speak and interact with the families. I watched as my daughter, my four-year-old daughter, was playing with toys with a group of other young kids who were in there just to get a meal. This is something that all of us have a real obligation to think about and to be serious about actually impacting, both because it's important for us to remember how lucky and blessed we are, but also it's important to understand what an obligation that we have as a large society to take care of and to support those who you know, at times find themselves in situations where they just need a bit of support.
That's Wes Moore, author and founder of Bridge EDU, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Michael J. Wilson, director of Maryland Hunger Solutions, and Deborah Flateman, CEO of the Maryland Food Bank. And you can be part of this conversation. What are your thoughts about how we should address this problem, which, as Wes Moore points out, is a problem for all of us, not just those who are hungry? You can call us locally, 410-662-8780. We also have a toll-free number. That's 866-661-9309. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Deborah, Wes Moore flew past a mention of a seat at the table. Give us the short version of what that is.
You know, we've been trying to develop something for quite some time that could be very broad-based, that could attract all kinds of people into supporting this work that the Maryland Food Bank does. We feel that we found it with Seat at the Table. And basically, what the message is $1 a day to the food bank can actually assure that a food insecure person is being fed for that day. So a $365 gift that can come to the food bank in monthly increments, if that's what you wish to do, can actually, you can create a virtual seat at your own table, knowing that when you sit down for a meal, you have already fed someone else. I think that's a really compelling message. I know that Wes and Don Moore thought that it was a really great message, and I'm thrilled that they're helping us to promote it. But we would really like to see this gain some traction. We think that it's something that even, you know, 20-somethings can think, geez, you know, $1 a day, it's not a whole lot of money. So I feel like it's an inclusive campaign that could really attract a lot of folks.
And Wes Moore, you're like the honorary chair of this.
Yeah.
So what kind of reaction is it getting? I mean, I'm sure, I have no doubt that many people say this is great, we should be doing it. But I mean, is it meeting, you've been at this now for a couple of months. Is it catching on the way you hoped it would?
Yes, and we're excited about the level of momentum that it's coming, that we're really trying to bring and help and watching being fostered into this. It's important for people to understand how thin that line is between our life and someone else's life. It's important for people to understand that when people say, well, why should I give? Why should I get involved in this cause when I have so many other causes that are pulling me? You know, I always say, just imagine that was you. You know, imagine that was your family. Imagine that you were the parent of that child, or you had a person, you know, in your family who, you know, you weren't sure how to explain to them where their next meal was going to come from. For such a small commitment, you really are changing the prospects and changing the level of hope for people who genuinely need it. And so just watching the support and the momentum that we received thus far and the promise for the momentum that will continue past the holidays has been incredibly gratifying and just very soul enriching.
I guess part of why I'm pressing you on how it's catching on is when you spoke a few minutes ago about the impact that hunger has in so many other public policy issues, problems that we talk about as a community, hunger seems almost invisible. Yeah. It comes up sometimes in education policy. Yeah. It comes up the idea that kids can't learn well when they come to school hungry. But other than that, it seems invisible. And I'm wondering, I mean, I think that's part of what you're about, Michael J. Wilson, is trying to make it more visible to us. Like, you're all about that. But how do you do that? I mean, because people who are hungry, I mean, unless you hear their stomach growl, and you hope it hasn't gotten to that point, we tend not to know. We can, you know, pass people on the street, be at work with people, and we don't know that they didn't know, they don't know where dinner's coming from.
Right. I think the invisibility is something that is real and that most folks don't think about. So whether it's one of your neighbors right down the street, you don't know if they have food in the refrigerator or not. Whether it's people who you work with, whether it's people who you associate with in other ways, you're not going to know necessarily that they're hungry. I'm reminded of a story by the director of the Manna Food Center, who talks about people waiting in line to get food from them, and they keep looking at their watches. And she's like, "What's going on?" She's like, "Well, I got to get back to work." You know, they're there to get food, but they're working people. And so the amount of invisibility here is real. And the other part of that we often talk about is the stigma that's attached to people who are getting charity or who are part of government programs. And that's a real thing that people deal with as well.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that later in the hour, too. I want to come back to that issue. We're going to need to take a break soon. And Wes Moore, I know you're going to need to leave us. And there's something I want to throw at you, and it may not be fair to ask you about it, but you are a veteran. And I have read that not only military when they come home, and we know about veterans who face homelessness, et cetera, and many of them face food insecurity. But yeah. I've also read that there are active duty families of active duty personnel on food stamps. What is your sense of the extent of the problem in the military community and what's being done about it?
So that's actually one of the big reasons why I wanted to get involved in this campaign. Because when we talk about food insecurity and we talk about hunger, you know, like you said, you know, we have people who are working full-time jobs, and this is still their reality, whether they be in the military or otherwise. But actually, there's a case study in the military that gives me a great sense of hope. Because one thing that I realize when you look at food insecurity is, you know, this is a choice that we're making, whether we're going to address this problem or whether we are not. I think, as Michael alluded to beautifully, we are far too wealthy a state to have as large a problem as we have. In 2008, the military made a decision, Department of Veterans Affairs and a group of other organizations, say we are going to attack veteran homelessness, and we are going to make sure that no veteran is homeless. Now, we haven't gotten quite yet to that point, but we have made a massive dent in the problem of veteran homelessness over the past six years. And it's because we made a choice to make a dent in it. And I think all we're saying on this issue, if we are going to have 78,000 plus people in this state who are hungry or who are food insecure, we need to make a collective choice to say we are going to address it the same way that the military decided to address this level of homelessness. And it's something that I know that we fundamentally can do.
It's a good thought, and I appreciate your sharing of with us. I know we have to say goodbye to you. I thank you for being part of this conversation. As I said, we're going to take a short break here. We're talking about food insecurity. We're going to continue with Deborah Flatman, CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, and Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. When we get back, we'll talk about one of the powerful ways to address food insecurity, school lunches. We'll find out how Somerset County Public Schools provide thousands of free meals to students last year. And we hope you join the conversation. Have you noticed people coping with food insecurity in places you didn't expect it? Have you or your family dealt with hunger? How did you do it? What can you tell others about it now? You can call us at 410-662-8780. Again, 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We're coming back in a minute to continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about hunger. One in eight Marylanders does not know where their next meal will come from, or may not know where their next meal will come from. The holiday season is a time of giving, a time when hunger is on many people's minds. But for thousands of our neighbors in Maryland, hunger is year-round. What are groups in Maryland doing to fight hunger and provide reliable and nutritious meals? With me in Studio A are Deborah Flateman, the CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, and Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. And Michael, let me just interrupt myself to say, what exactly does Maryland Hunger Solutions do? I know what the food bank does. Right. Deborah and I have talked before, and the concept of making food available, even though there's all kinds of creative ways to do it that I may not foresee, but I kind of have a sense of what the food bank is about. I'm not quite sure what Hunger Solutions does.
Right. So if people need emergency food, we refer them to the food bank or to the Capital Area Food Bank. We do not do emergency food. We work to help people get signed up for the federal nutrition programs. We're authorized by the Department of Human Resources. We actually sign people up for food stamps all around the state. In addition, we train other nonprofit partners around the state to sign people up for food stamps. We know ending hunger in the state of Maryland isn't something we can do alone, so we work with other partners. We also work with connecting people to different federal nutrition programs, whether it's the WIC program.
Women, Infants, and Children.
That's correct. I'm on the state WIC advisory committee. And we work with the schools to work on school programs like school lunch, school breakfast, after-school meals, summer meals. And we do advocacy at the state and federal level, trying to improve and advocate for programs that can help end hunger in the state of Maryland.
And let me remind our listeners, and some already are taking me up on this, if you've got some thoughts about how we can address hunger, if you've got some insight into what it means to be coping with hunger, give us a call, please. 410-662-8780 is our local number. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. We also have a toll-free number if you're calling from some distance. That's 866-661-9309. We would love to hear from you. Michael J. Wilson said a magic word, and that is schools, and that gives me a perfect segue to introduce the superintendent of Somerset County Public Schools, Dr. John Gaddis. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gaddis.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be on.
I'm glad you could join us. Census data show that more than one-third of children in your county, 34%, and about one-fourth of adults in Somerset County live below the poverty line. The median household income there is about half that of Maryland overall, $36,000 versus $74,000 for the whole state. Dr. Gaddis, what impact does hunger have on kids in Somerset County Public Schools?
One of the things that we noticed and why we moved forward with the community eligibility provision is because of the impacts that we saw on our children. We had quite a few children in a problem countywide with...
Oh, I think we just lost you. Dr. Gaddis, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Wait, I hear you again now. I lost. You said a problem countywide, and then there was kind of an ominous silence. So pick up that point.
We had a problem countywide with tardies and absenteeism. We also started looking at our data, and our discipline in the morning was really, really bad. And then we started a conversation. But more importantly, we noticed... because we were looking at data, that our free and reduced lunch rate was at about 74%. And so we started wondering if we went to a program where our students weren't hungry during the day, what would that do and what would that mean? And again, when you look at our students and you talk to them and you talk to our community, we found out that food insecurity and having hungry students during the day was a big problem for our county.
And so you joined this federal program that allows you to provide free meals to all your students. If I understood you correctly, you already had about three quarters of your students getting free, a reduced price lunch. Why did you feel you needed to escalate, and how were you able to pull all the students into a free lunch situation?
We had conversations with Michael Wilson's organization, as well as people at the Maryland State Department of Education, And what we found out when we had to collect data, students who were part of the free and reduced lunch program had to fill out a paper. And of that 73-74%, about 80% of that came from the elementary level. And what we started looking at was what's going on at the high school level. Students in high school will not stand in line and punch in a number or say that they're on free and reduced meals. And we thought that that was our biggest issue. So when we had the opportunity, there are a variety of ways you can set the program up. And we looked at just doing certain schools because we have one area of the county where we had a very low free and reduced lunch count. And we said, no, let's do the whole system. So in looking at that, we jumped in with both feet, and it has been an incredible program to bring to the county. And we have found out that, in fact, we were correct. The greatest growth in the amount of meals served has been in our two high schools. And so we were able to meet a need not only specifically for those high schools, but for the entire county, as it was incredible the amount of extra meals that we served during last school year.
And have you seen, it may be too soon for this, but have you seen an impact on performance in school?
Well, we're looking at a number of measures because it's always hard when you talk about what has changed performance, specifically academic performance, because we have so many initiatives going on. But what I can tell you the data shows us is tardies are down, absenteeism. We have all-time attendance rates. Discipline in the morning is down considerably by almost 40%. And so what that tells us is that the students are taking advantage of the program. And last year alone, we served 105,000 more meals than the year before. And to date this year, we're up over that, even a couple thousand meals, even though attendance is down a little bit in the county. So that data is up, and we feel as though, in combination with other positive things going on, that our students are more attentive. They're not hungry, because every student receives a meal at no cost, breakfast and lunch. And we do believe that has a tremendous impact, not only in the performance, but in how our students are acting in our schools.
That's the superintendent of Somerset County Public Schools, Dr. John Gaddis, here on Midday on WYPR. With me in the studio are Deborah Flateman, CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, and Michael J. Wilson, director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Michael J. Wilson, Dr. Gaddis, I don't believe used the same word that you used a few minutes ago. I don't believe Dr. Gaddis said the stigma word, but it seemed to me... Well, I don't know. Maybe he was just, is what he's describing with high school kids won't stand in line and punch in a number, is that, you know, sort of just teenagers being teenagers, or is that stigma, or is it the same thing?
It's both of those issues. And let me go back for a second, because I think Dr. Gaddis is being a little modest here. I mean, not only have they served more meals, but another metric by which he is measured is they've made more money for the school district because they have served more meals. And so the school district has benefited not just in dealing with the health and nutrition of the students, but they've also financially benefited by being a part of the community eligibility provision. And he has been a star talking to other superintendents around the state. And so when we were able to expand this program because of some legislation in Annapolis earlier this year, it's when Baltimore City began to be able to serve free breakfast and lunch to all of its students. There was an additional school in Howard County. There were additional schools in Prince George's County. The program has expanded, and, you know, John Gaddis has been one of the leading voices for this.
But I'm going to hold that thought. I want to interrupt to make sure I'm understanding. I thought the funding for the free and reduced lunch was entirely federal. Am I wrong?
It is.
So what role does the state legislation play?
Right. So this is one of those anomalies in legislation where it was done at the federal level and that there was a local impact, because Maryland also used those same free and reduced meal forms in order to calculate compensatory education funding. And there was no way for Washington, D.C. to understand or to to be able to calculate that in. And other states have similar issues. So what we did at the state level was we enacted legislation to make sure that schools wouldn't have an impact on their compensatory education funding by not collecting the free and reduced meal forms. We did a couple of fixes on that, and that's what helped expand it at the state level. But the stigma question that you raise is an important one. So teenagers are very, very cognizant of stigma, and it's about being a teenager, and it's about everything else that's going on in their lives at that time. And so by going district-wide, what Somerset County was able to do was to eliminate the stigma, because it wasn't just about you and it wasn't just about your friends. Everybody had free breakfast and free lunch. And so that's why you had increased meals, and that's why you had increased participation.
Deborah Flatman, is stigma something that the food bank has to work around, or by the time people come to the food bank, have they come to grips with the stigma and it's no longer an issue for them?
Well, we don't really serve people directly. Only in a couple of our programs do we do direct service, but we, of course, work with a whole bunch of partner agencies out mm-hmm. there.
And what do you hear from them?
We hear that, yes, it's very difficult still for people to walk through the doors of the local pantry. There is stigma attached. As hard as we work with our agencies to really, in the best way possible, provide the service with inclusion and dignity and lack of scrutiny and that sort of thing, I honestly feel that the idea of stigma won't disappear until food for all people becomes mainstream. You know, when the whole system becomes integrated and mainstreamed, and people in general are making sure that all people have access to adequate food, only then will the stigma totally, you know, I think, disappear.
We're going to take a break soon, but I'm going to squeeze in a phone call from Lauren in Baltimore. Lauren, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I have a question for Deborah Flatman. And my question is really, I'm really happy to see that the food bank is looking at ways to reduce food insecurity. And I'm really wondering how you all are measuring that and how you're looking at research to, support that as well.
Sure. Well, we're affiliated with Feeding America, which is a national consortium of food banks, about 200 food banks across the country. And Feeding America does a lot of really good research that informs all of us across the country how well we're doing. Basically, about 4 years ago, they conduct a study called Map the Meal Gap. And in real terms, we finally have some data that tells us how many meals are missing. And of course, our goal is to make up that gap, whatever that number is. So as we see ourselves advance in providing more meals to the community, we would assume that we're creating a more stable community. But the idea of research is really a good one. I appreciated what Dr. Gaddis was saying about gathering what data that they can. You know, the Maryland Food Bank is very much on a platform these days of talking very seriously about how food can be the catalyst for amazing change. And Dr. Gaddis' story is evidence of that. We talk about, just as Wes talked about earlier, we talk about the effect of food and reducing or eliminating food insecurity on the areas of education. There are all kinds of studies out there that tell us that if kids eat well, they learn better and they do better in school. We talk about, you know, health. It's obvious if you eat better, you're going to have better health outcomes. We talk about job readiness. I spoke with the GBC board a couple of weeks ago and the Greater Baltimore Committee and said to them, you know, we can bring business into Baltimore, but I dare say that we may not have the workforce to support it. A lot of people are waking up in the morning, making their full-time job, trying to find food to feed their families. You know, what kind of stability can food being put first, actually create an impact? And finally, I would say the area of safety, because it's my hunch that I know that if my child was hungry, I would do whatever I needed to do to be able to make sure that my child was fed. I'm remembering something that I heard during the unrest in April on the radio where, you know, a guy was quoted as saying, they call us thugs. We haven't eaten in 3 days. So I think that there's something there, but we don't have the data. The research hasn't happened, and we don't have the data to really, really define how, if we were to eliminate food insecurity, how different would our world be in all of those areas?
A powerful thought. We should think about that while we take this short break. We're discussing, of course, hunger and food insecurity and ways of addressing it locally, statewide, and federally. Our guests are Deborah Flateman, President and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, and Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. And Dr. John Gaddis, Superintendent of Schools in Somerset County, is on the line with us. Dr. Gaddis, can you stay with us a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
Terrific. So we're going to take a short break, and we will all be back, and we hope you will join us. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about hunger in Maryland. Our guests are Deborah Flateman, President and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions, John Gaddis, Dr. John Gaddis, Superintendent of Schools in Somerset County. We have a call from Nancy in Baltimore. Nancy, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I'm calling because I am a returned Peace Corps volunteer. And I also worked here in Baltimore in the city schools as a social worker. I am 73 years old. I now depend on food stamps. And I also am helped by people in my church. I couldn't manage without it. One of the issues that I wanted to say was, as Wes Moore pointed out with the veterans, there are many, many returned Peace Corps volunteers who are now homeless and on food stamps because of illnesses they contracted abroad. And when I applied for food stamps through a social worker at my senior center, she mailed everything in on June 1st. At the end of July, I called to find out my status. The person at the DSS office said, "We have nothing on you at all." I told him the address that the social worker had to mail it in. He said, "Oh, that office closed several months ago, and we have none of the mail that went there."
My goodness. You're a social worker yourself. That must have really hit you between the eyes. So how long did it take from when you started in June until you were on the roll to get food, until you actually got food stamps?
August.
Till August.
Right. And if that happens to me, who has some background in how the system works, I'm sure I'm not the only one. And that's a concern for me. And as I said, I'm in a position where people from my church have known about my situation and have offered me help, which is such a blessing. There may be other people who don't have that experience, and it's of great concern. And I also, because I'm a diabetic, have to be careful about the foods that I eat, and it's not always manageable.
I really appreciate your calling us, Nancy. Deborah?
Yeah, you know, we do SNAP outreach or food stamp outreach primarily with elders. And I think what makes our activity so successful is that once we meet with the elder, get the information, create the application, we actually follow the application through the entire process. And so we've been very successful at getting people onto the benefits. I think with any bureaucratic type of a program, these types of horrible things can happen, and it's such a sad story. But that kind of reminds me, you know, Nancy's story is like a million other stories that are out there, and I might mention that your listeners could go to one.mdfoodbank.org, and if you go there, you'll get involved in our multimedia campaign that highlights story after story after story of real people like you and me out in our community who are dealing with food insecurity, and how different their stories are, and yet how there are certain threads that absolutely link them.
Michael?
Well, I mean, like Deb, we sign people up for food stamps and we follow them through the process. And as she says, these kinds of mistakes happen and we try to address them. We talk to the Department of Human Resources and their...
This is the State Department of Human Resources processes the applications for this federal benefit.
That's exactly right. And we talk to them regularly dealing with issues like this and cases like this. And they are heartbreaking because you often have people who are eligible, who are delayed getting the benefits that they need. And so we're trying to address this as well. And we're trying to help folks from around the state who deal with this as well.
Nancy reached us here on Midday by calling 410-662-8780. You can do that too, 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We got an email from someone who asked us not to name them because they don't want to embarrass their family. And this is what they wrote. My son and wife have a large family and run out of dollars for groceries. He's a decorated combat veteran with more than 10 years of service. They live in military housing and shop in the commissary, which helps, but not enough. The stigma is so great, especially for someone who is not a new recruit, that they would rather cut back on fresh produce and high-quality proteins than be seen requesting help. Is that something you run into, too?
Absolutely.
Is this common?
This is the classic case of stigma, that they don't want to be seen as having to get help when they obviously need help. And this happens especially among folks who are employed, folks who are in the military, and folks who, you know, just don't want to have to deal with this. Many, and I think Deb would corroborate this, as part of the Great Recession, we saw more people using the food supplement program in Maryland than we had in ages. And it was a lot of folks who normally never thought they would be on food stamps. And in a lot of cases, fortunately for them.
In terms of addressing the stigma, would it make sense for people to, like, wear, you know, if they want to, obviously, voluntarily, somehow let it be known, hey, I use food stamps, you know, it's okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, would there be a way of people sort of in the program being able to explode the stigma?
I
don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think there people have stigma because of their own perceptions of what these things are.
But if we're talking about something that affects one out of eight Marylanders,
right? I'm very
clearly, you know, it's too widespread. It's so widespread that it's perverse that there's stigma attached to it.
And so I'm very clear about when I talk to people about this. This is a benefit which you've earned. This is a benefit which you deserve. And this is not something you should have any stigma or shame about. You should utilize the program and take care of yourself and your family. That's why it exists.
We find with a lot of elderly folks especially, you know, they're kind of like, leave it for someone who really needs it.
Right.
And our big pitch to them is, listen, did you work in your life? Yes. You paid taxes. This is an entitlement program. This is your turn now to take advantage of these benefits so that you can get by. Going back to the military issue, though, we've been working with the USO to do food drops on bases or nearby bases, and we've had huge success with that, just to let you know.
David in Baltimore has a different point of view. David, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Oh, very, very, very important show, and thank you for having it. I have a question, I guess sort of a comment also, if the guest could comment on. What I'm seeing in some of the circles that I travel in, not the fact that people don't have enough food stamps allowance, but with the advent of welfare reform, they're having to barter or sell their food stamp allowance in order to have more cash, which is causing them to not have enough food to feed their families.
You're linking that bartering, the incentive to barter food stamps for cash, presumably cash at a lower, fewer dollars than the face value of the food stamps. You link that to welfare reform. Why?
The welfare reform, it actually reduced the amount of cash that people were receiving as to supplement their income or subsistence, so that they're running out of cash. You know, you can't use food stamps to catch a taxi. You can't use food stamps to buy a bus pass. So they're using the money that's allowed for food for their families in order to subsidize their cash income, which is causing them not to have enough food to feed their families. And that all started, I think, out of welfare reform when people just aren't receiving enough cash benefits anymore.
Let me ask Michael J. Wilson to address that.
So there are two important points here, and I want to make sure we get both of them right. First of all, for people to barter or use their food stamps in that way is illegal, and it will cause them not only to lose their benefits, but will prevent them from ever getting food stamp benefits again. It's not like when there were food stamps, when you could give somebody some stamps. They use an electronic benefit card. They can track the transaction. People who are trafficking in this way are playing with fire, and they're going to lose their benefits. The second point is the underlying issue is not just welfare reform. It's always been about poverty. People who are looking for ways to be able to stretch their dollars or be able to take care of their families and put food on the table are dealing with the issue of poverty. And it's when we address poverty in a substantial way, raising the minimum wage, providing for paid sick leave, increasing the earned income tax credit, all of those are helpful, but it's poverty that is the driver of all of these things that he's describing.
I have a question that I want to get to John Gaddis before we're out of time. John Gaddis, the superintendent of schools in Somerset County. Dr. Gaddis, schools are closed now for the holidays in Somerset. They don't open again until January 4th. What does that mean for families that depended a lot on their kids getting a free breakfast, free lunch? And how do you address that?
Well, that's a big issue for us, and that's something that is a big concern. We were able to send what we call holiday bags home with some of the students. But because of the economic situation in the county, we weren't able to keep our schools open to be able to serve food. And so for us, we know what's going to happen. We know that a student who comes to us 5 days a week, we serve them 10 meals. If they are involved in after-school programs, we partnered with the Maryland Food Bank, and we serve a dinner. So for some of our students, they receive 15 meals a week, and now they're going home, and they're not going to have that. So that's a tremendous concern. So in moving forward, we've started applying for grants because we're concerned about spring break. We're really concerned about the summertime and what we want to be able to do. And so we have heavy hearts right now because it is a huge problem. And I can tell you from our perspective, no one talked about it. And when Michael Wilson's group came to us and we sat at that table and we talked and we really started to understand the fact that we had to do something, we're so glad we did, but we have heavy hearts now because we don't have a way over Christmas break to be able to make sure our kids eat.
Dr. Gaddis, we're flat out of time. I really do appreciate your giving us that insight. Dr. John Gaddis, Superintendent of Schools in Somerset County. And my thanks also to Deborah Flateman, CEO and President of the Maryland Food Bank, and Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. We'll have information about a seat at the table. We'll link to the Maryland Food Bank from our website. We're grateful also, as we talk about hunger, to the Diz Restaurant for supplying lunch today for our midday guests. It's located in the heart of Remington, 300 West 30th Street. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, breakfast served weekends, on the web at www.thedizbaltimore.com. Tomorrow on Midday, traumatic brain injuries impact mood, memory, and behavior. You want to tune in for that. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Sheila Cass. See you tomorrow.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Dronberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.